You know, it was last month we held a weekend, a special weekend, leadership weekend for what we call our young adults. Now, young adult is kind of a floating term, anywhere from about age 20 to about age 40, and thereabouts is considered a young adult these days. And depending upon your age, you probably would raise that up a little more. But we had a very special weekend. We're very happy we're able to do that. We certainly feel like we should invest more in our young adults, the young people coming along. We're very happy to have them as a part of the church. It's a particularly different struggle probably for some of them coming along than maybe it was for many of us, many years ago when we came through that age group. But we believe it's very special or very important that we do something for them. We had close to 400 people attended in 7 different locations. We were, again, very, very pleased with that. We felt we were able to accomplish a good bit. I'm sure some of you may have been involved as well over in Fort Worth. But we wanted to accomplish a lot during that very short period of time. We're very pleased that in the congregations or in our church attendance in the United States that we now have more accurate statistics than we've been able to put together in the past, that 30% of our church attendance in the U.S. is under the age of 30. And that's very good. Now, again, depending on where you are, some people say, well, we don't have any young people in our congregation. Well, then you go to another congregation, they have 6 babies being born before the days of unleavened bread, at a congregation of 120 people. So that, that things are different in different locations. But overall, 30% of our church attendance is under the age of 30. Now, that's 0 to 30, so it's not that they're all teenagers or all, preteen. They're that whole age group there. And that's very favorable and looks, certainly we believe, very good for the future. But we have a responsibility to help them and encourage them and to be able to involve them in our congregations and our churches. And that's very important to us. So this past month when we had the weekend, we focused on one particular aspect, not just of young adults, but of Christianity. And over that 2-day period, beginning with certainly presentations, lectures on the Sabbath, church services, an activity on Saturday night, and then we would have more on Sunday. We focused on the subject of faith. We began by asking the question which Jesus Christ asked, and that is, when he returns, will he really find faith on earth? And that's a powerful question to ask, and it's one that we sometimes don't ask often enough of ourselves as to where are we on that continuum of faith and how does that affect us, every single one of us. I've thought about it a lot, and of course in preparing for the weekend, is often the case, you put yourself into more of a detailed study of a particular subject. And while there really isn't anything particularly new about the subject of faith, it is such a significant subject that we need to certainly speak about it. We need to talk about it. We need to obviously study so that we can, in our own hearts and minds, realize the significance of this one particular subject. So I'd like to continue some of that here this afternoon. I've actually titled the sermon, The Hall of Faith. To me, it was always interesting to go to the various sports halls of fame. We went to the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown a number of years ago. We've not actually been in the Football Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio, but we've been over to the Basketball Hall of Fame in Springfield, Massachusetts. So the idea that the Hall of Fame, where people have, by their effort, been able to qualify and be a part of that or their sports accomplishments. How about the Hall of Faith? The Hall of Faith. Who would be included there? What is that really, or what would that really be all about? And I think you might be surprised at what the Bible actually tells us about that subject. Well, let me begin with a story. You've all heard of, I'm sure, the great scientist Albert Einstein. For many people, he is considered the smartest person who ever lived, at least in modern times. Obviously, we could dispute that over historical times, but he was quite a brilliant man. But like a lot of brilliant people, he had a few quirks about him, a few things that made him a little different. He looked a little different. He was easily recognizable in his appearance. So this is supposedly a true story. says, Einstein was once traveling on a train going from Princeton to, I believe he was going to New York. And the conductor walks down the aisle, as they normally do in the trains, a passenger train of that day, and begins collecting the tickets. You know, and he punches all of the tickets, and he comes to Dr. Einstein. And he's searching and looking, and he can't find his ticket. So he's all over, he can't find his ticket. So the conductor says, that's all right. I know who you are. You're Dr. Einstein, and don't worry. Don't worry about it. He said, well, I need to find my ticket. I need to find my ticket. He said, no, that's all right. Sit down. It's okay. Don't worry about it. So the conductor goes on, and he's about to go to the next car. He looks back, and there's Einstein down on his hands and knees, and he's searching and looking, got his briefcase out, and he's looking all over. So the conductor goes back, and he says, Dr. Einstein, don't worry. I know who you are. You don't have to find your ticket. He says, young man, I also know who I am, but I don't know where I'm going. And supposedly a true story that, you know, he couldn't find his ticket. His ticket was going to tell him where he was going. If you think about it for a moment, you and I know who we are. We're Christians. But where are we going? And do we really know? And do we clearly know what lies ahead? We can talk about it. We can preach about it. We can do all sorts of things. But do you really know what's ahead? That's where faith comes in. That's where what faith is really, in some ways, all about. Faith is also knowing where you're going, not just who you are. It's knowing where you're going. Let's go to Hebrews 11, verse 1. I think you'll all familiar with this particular verse and this particular chapter. You could really call this chapter at least a listing of individuals who, for one reason or another, certainly appear here. There are a variety of individuals listed here, but they're all listed in reference to faith. They're all listed here in reference to faith. A clear definition of faith is given here in verse 1. Now, we're going to come back to this in a moment, but consider this entire chapter. Verse 6 says it's impossible to please God without faith. It's a pretty clear statement. It's impossible to please God without faith. That's, again, as I said, pretty powerful statement there. Faith has a lot to do with, again, with knowing where you're going, as well as, of course, knowing who you are. Faith is the fuel that drives the engine of Christianity. Faith is the fuel that drives the engine of Christianity. Consider this chapter 11. You ever broken it down? There are 16 individuals named in this chapter by name. Now, there's a reference by events, but there are 16 that are named by name. Two women are Sarah and Rahab. But what about others? What about those that aren't listed here? Abigail, Ruth, Rachel, Rebecca, Deborah. Or what about some of the others? Joshua isn't listed. Shem isn't listed. Daniel, Elijah, Elisha, Josiah are not mentioned in this chapter. Now, to be very clear, I don't remotely, and in fact, I'm pretty sure that's not the case, that this was to be an exhaustive listing of everyone. But why these individuals? A couple of them are rather obscure. Jephthah, Barak. These are rather obscure individuals in the pages of the Bible. Nothing like a Daniel or an Ezekiel, and yet they're not listed. There was something unique about each one of these individuals that prompted the author of Hebrews, and we believe it was most likely the Apostle Paul, to list them here. There's something very special about this group of individuals. And I'd like to explore that with you this afternoon, is what was special about them and what can we learn? What can we see in regards to faith and how it applies to us today based upon Hebrews 11? And there's a tremendous amount in this one chapter. But first of all, let's back up a moment and let's look at faith in general. What does faith have to do with our lives today? Well, I think you would all agree with me that it really has everything to do with our lives today. Faith is listed in Matthew 23, and you don't have to turn to these places, but Matthew 23, verse 23, faith is one of the weightier matters of the law. It's a weightier matter of the law. That's pretty powerful. Ephesians 2, verses 8 through 9 says, we are saved by faith. We're saved by faith. Romans 1:17, the just live by faith. Romans 5:1, we are justified by faith. 2 Corinthians 1:24, we stand firm in our belief by faith. Galatians 3:14, we receive the promise of the Spirit by faith. In Galatians 5, verse 5, we await Christ's return by faith. So you see this reference, or the references to faith, as really being significant. It's not a minor subject. In fact, it's such a huge subject, I don't propose in one sermon to even be able to wrap my arms around all of the things that are here. But I hope to provide you with something here today that can take us, as we approach the Passover, which was referred to in the sermonette, help us see the future and look ahead and see what God really has in store and what he wants us to see when it comes to the faith that we should have. Now let's go back to Hebrews 11, verse 1. You're hopefully still there. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. There are 66 books in the Bible, as we have it today, written by more than 40 authors in three different languages. And yet this is the only verse in the entirety of the Bible that has the statement, faith is. The only verse. It's one of the most controversial verses. It's argued and debated by scholars as to exactly what does this mean. Specifically, the word substance is debated, as it's translated in the New King James. It's translated other things in other places, assurance in some, different things in other places. But now, faith is the substance. What does that mean? What does that word mean? It said that this is one of the most difficult verses in the Bible, but it seems quite simple. Faith is. In this case, we have both the understanding of the verse and the application of the verse are in question. In other words, what is Paul saying? There are several ways this verse is translated. The New King James says, I have faith is the substance. The New Living Translation, faith is the confidence. The New American Standard Bible, faith is the assurance. In West, the New Testament Expanded says, faith is the title deed of things hoped for. Now, we'll talk a little bit more about a title deed as a legal document. So we're talking about something that has relevance when you're talking about legal documents, certainly to the society then and even to our society today, to help people understand the significance of what faith really is. The one word, the word that is under the most scrutiny is the word translated substance. The Greek word is actually hypostasis. Some say hypostasis. It can be either one. There are different ways of writing in the Greek. It's not always all the same, even though it may be the same word. Vines defines this word as a standing under, a support, hupo meaning under, and histeme meaning to stand, hence an assurance, or a substance as is translated here, something that stands underneath, that holds everything up. Now you think about that in Christianity. That faith is really what holds everything up. Knowledge is important. You need to know about the Sabbath. You need to know about the holy days. You need to know what is expected of you. But you must be standing on what? You know, you can't stand on knowledge, at least not knowledge alone. What are you standing on? What is underneath you? What holds you up that cannot be seen, but it keeps you upright? Robertson's Word Pictures of the New Testament. Hupostasis is a very common word from Aristotle on and comes from hupohistome, what stands under anything, a building, a contract, or a promise is what stands behind it or under it, I should say. Very important concept. West writes, it is important that the preliminary definition be clearly understood. Since the following example illustrates it, that is the following examples, the people that follow are going to illustrate this point. And the way chapter 11 is written, you have the statement, this is what faith is. Now I'm going to tell you how it is manifest. And you see a listing of individuals and different things that they did. This is how faith was manifest. Because you see, faith can't be seen. It's the substance underneath. It's what keeps you standing. It's what keeps you going. It's what prevents you from lying down and giving up. It's a very, very important concept. So he says, the key is furnished by verse 27, and we'll come to that in a moment, as seeing him who is invisible. Faith apprehends as a real fact what is not revealed to the senses. It rests on the fact, acts upon it, and upheld it, or by it, in the face of all that seems to contradict it. Faith is real seeing. The word substance deserves careful treatment. It is hupostasis, made up of stasis to stand and hupo under, thus that which stands under a foundation. Thus it speaks of the ground on which one builds a hope. A ground upon which one builds a hope. And then in the vocabulary of the Greek New Testament by Moulton and Milligan, reports this is a legal term. And outside of the Bible and outside of some references in Aristotle, it is used extensively in legal documents. This hupostasis. In other words, it's the backing behind the document. It's what the document is built upon. It goes on to say, faith is the, reports it as a legal term. They say that it stands for the whole body of documents bearing on the ownership of a person's property, deposited in archives and forming the evidence of ownership. They suggest the translation, faith is the title deed of things hoped for. Hupostasis can be seen as the unseen support of that which is standing. So we see that faith is the real foundation upon which we must build. It is something that cannot be seen. As I said, Wust uses the word title deed. I'm sure you've heard a lot about title deeds here. What does a title do for you? It promises you that you really own this property. And you may have never seen the property. The title deed, though, describes you as the owner. A clear title means what? That there's no dispute on the ownership. So you see where this lexicon comes back with this word of title deed. Faith is the title deed. It's a piece of paper that says you own something that you cannot see. Somebody could bring the title in to whatever property. We bought homes over the years, and you pay a title company to make sure that this title is free of any challenges and that you actually own the property. And you can go show that to everybody in your family. Oh, that's wonderful. You own the property. They've never seen the property. They don't even know if it exists. But that piece of paper assures them it's there. It really does exist. So to look at faith as really the title deed, it's what assures you that what you believe is really true, is really true. Hebrews chapter 11 is written in a form of literature or a style of literature that's called an anaphora. Anaphora, I guess, would be a better way of saying it. An anaphora is where you take one word or phrase and you repeat it for emphasis over and over during the course of either your speech, if it's speaking, or in the course of an article or a poem as you're writing. An example of anaphora would be Winston Churchill's famous speech. And you probably remember it. It says, we shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. And we shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. Again, the repetition of we shall fight over and over. And you've heard other speeches and other speakers and other authors who use that form. It's called anaphora or anaphora. And this is found here in this chapter. There are other places in the Bible where you find it as well, but Hebrews 11 is an excellent example of that. By faith is repeated 18 times in this one chapter. By faith. Look at verse 3. By faith we understand. 4. By faith Abel offered. By faith Enoch was taken. By faith Noah. By faith Abraham. By faith he dwelt. By faith Sarah. And you continue on through the chapter. You know, you get by faith Abraham. By faith Isaac. By faith Jacob. By faith Joseph. By faith Moses. By faith he forsook. By faith he kept the Passover. By faith they passed through. 18 times in this one chapter alone, the phrase by faith. The point of emphasis should not be lost on us. Nothing can be done of value in the eyes of God without faith. Nothing of value. It is by faith that we live, by faith that we breathe, and by faith that we accomplish anything that we accomplish. It must be the foundation. It must be what we build upon. It must be what keeps us upright every single day of our lives. It's a very, very important concept. If you study Hebrews 11, you will find, now you could come up with your own list, I suppose, but there are three major aspects of faith that are found in this chapter. And I believe the reason these individuals were selected, that Paul used them, wasn't because they were the only ones that had faith. It was because they had a particular type of faith or a manifestation of faith that brought out these very, very important principles about faith. So I want to take a look this afternoon at these three major principles of faith. You might say these are the three legs of a stool that define faith. Again, the definition is given in verse 1. Faith is. But then you have all of these examples to explain further how we should understand faith and how faith is so significant in our lives. You know, when you go to the Passover and participate in the Passover, there is an element of faith there. Now, don't get me wrong, you can go to Passover and you can sit and go through it like a ritual, and you can get up and go back home and you've completed another Passover, another year. But if you understand the meaning of Passover and why you're really there, you know there's an element of faith in that. Faith in what? Well, faith that Christ really existed. Faith that he died. Faith that he suffered. Faith that he will return. Faith that there's a future. It's not just tonight. We don't do this just kind of to cover our, to hedge our bets a bit. Well, maybe he really will come, so maybe I better go to Passover. Maybe I'm really going to be held accountable for what I've done. I better go to Passover. Or is there this foundation of faith that holds you up and that you go to Passover year after year and you sit there, you wash feet, you look, your brother in his eye, you kneel down, you wash his feet, and then you go back and you partake of the bread and the wine because you know what those mean. Those aren't just symbols. They are symbols. They're not real. I don't mean that at all in the sense of the real body and blood of Christ. But we know that there really was a Jesus Christ. There really was, he really did shed his blood. He really did get beaten, and we really can come to him. And we really can claim that sacrifice when we're ill or when we're sick and when we're anointed. So what is it about this chapter? What is it about these 16 individuals that are named here that we can learn about faith? Well, I'll give you the three lessons or principles of faith that are found in this chapter, but then I want to go through each one. First of all, there's a pretty easy one. It's called vision. We refer to it as vision. You'll see this found in verse 13, Hebrews 11, verse 13. We'll look there, but we're going to come back to this more than once. Verse 13 says, "These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off." True faith, real faith, genuine faith must have vision. You must be able to see something that isn't even here yet. You have to be able to focus your attention and your ability to see and therefore go through things that aren't all that pleasant in this life, because you're going to see things that aren't here yet. The title deed, the promise, the foundation. Secondarily, faith involves a willingness to suffer rather than compromise. Look at verse 24, Hebrews 11, verse 24. Verse 24. "By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin." So there's an element of faith that says you are willing to suffer rather than compromise. Suffer rather than compromise. That's a very, very important concept. Sometimes there's an overwhelming desire to just get along, to just get along. And we advocate, you know, as it says in Romans, that we should be at peace with all people as much as lies within us. There's never any scriptural support for compromising what is right in order to simply get along. Willing to suffer rather than compromise. And then number three is found in verse 34. Breaking into this, this is a whole series of individuals and things that they went through. It says, quenched by violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong. Out of weakness were made strong. Until you recognize, or until I recognize, that of and by ourselves we are weak, then faith is really not a factor in your life. Because if you're strong yourself, then maybe you don't need that foundation. Maybe you don't need that faith. Well, that's, you know, as I say, I speak as a fool. But you have to recognize that you're weak. You have to recognize it. Otherwise, where is the faith? So an element of faith is, out of weakness, we must be made strong. So vision, willingness to suffer rather than compromise, out of weakness being made strong. Three lessons of faith, the three legs of a stool that identify the significance of this one chapter in all of our lives as we go forward into the future. I read a book a few weeks ago, actually a few months ago now, about the Wright brothers. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever seen that book or not, but if you want to talk about vision, one of the more outstanding examples in the physical world that I've ever read, or at least read in recent years, is the story of the Wright brothers. Now, if you were to list the world's 10 greatest inventions in the past 1,000 years, this might be the list you would have. You can find different lists in different places, but the printing press, obviously. The electric light, the automobile, the telephone, the radio, the television, vaccination, some would say, the computer, gas-powered tractor, anesthesia, and the airplane would always be in that list. Imagine what the life would be like today if there were no airplanes. Consider what life would be like if man had not flown in a, powered flight, if that had not been invented. You know, beginning around 1850, several individuals from different areas of the world were working on gliders that could carry a person. Some of these experiments ended in tragedy, and none of them were really successful. Wilbur and Orville Wright were brothers who lived in Dayton, Ohio, and with their sister and their father. They never married. They were bachelors their entire lives. Their mother died in 1889 of tuberculosis. And the two older brothers married and left home. But Wilbur, the oldest brother, and Orville, the younger brother, never married. Stayed at home with their father and their sister, who also didn't marry. Each day he would read to them, or I should say each day they liked to read books. They read a lot of books. They had a bicycle factory, bicycle shop. They repaired bicycles. They built bicycles. They designed bicycles and had a successful little business in Dayton, Ohio. But Orville, in 1896, Orville came down with typhoid fever, and his older brother Wilbur nursed him back to health. It was with him every day. And would read books to him over and over again. They all liked to read. And he read a particular book by Otto Lilienthal on the development of a glider. And Lilienthal was convinced that man could fly, and the answer lay in studying the birds and how they flew and how the winds worked. And so they had a particular idea in mind. So they became enamored by flight. But they were bicycle repairmen. The two boys, they were not engineers. They never went to college. They had no money really to speak of. And because of a lot of people who were trying to be the first for powered flight, and they were all failing over and over again, they would fail, and another one would fail. One scientist wrote toward the end of the 1800s, flight is a dream that can never be a reality. Flight is a dream that can never be a reality. But about that time, several wealthy people got involved in thinking, well, we can actually do this. And so a group of some of the greatest inventors in the history of the world, Alexander Graham Bell, Thomas Edison, combined with a fellow named Samuel Langley to build the first powered flight. And they had unlimited resources. They had a $100,000 grant to build this machine. And they worked feverishly to get it built to be the first ones. And they built this machine, and they were going to launch it. They had hundreds of newspaper reporters across the Potomac River. They were going to fly across the Potomac River. So they had the top of a houseboat. They built the plane, put it on the top of this houseboat, and they were going to fly it. They had a pilot lying down on this plane. He was going to fly it across. They crank up the motor, and they begin to push it off. And guess what? It goes straight down in the Potomac River. Horrible disaster. $100,000, the smartest people in the world working on it, and it failed. And a lot of people began to assume at that point, it'll never happen. Man will never fly. But Orville and Wilbur Wright believed differently. And they knew that there was a fatal flaw to all of the previous ones who had tried this. They determined that it had to do not only with the draft of the air going over the wing, but there also had to be a pickup underneath the wing. And they designed it over and over again. And finally, on December the 17th, 1903, they flew the first successful powered flight machine. Using a small gasoline engine, Orville flew for 59 seconds and covered a distance of 852 feet at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. They were ecstatic. They had succeeded. They had invested less than $1,000 in the entire machine. But they had no college education. They had no formal technical training. They had no experience working with anyone other than themselves. They ran their own bicycle shop. They had no friends in high places. They had no financial backers. They had no government subsidies and only a little money of their own. But they had something that money could not buy. They had vision. They could see a plane flying. They could see themselves sitting on this plane, and they could see it flying. And no one could convince them differently. And after they had success with this plane, they go back and they rebuilt another one. They rebuilt that one, changed things slightly. And before you knew it, they had a plane that would fly around a field for hours at a time and would turn and would climb and would dive and all of these things. And they became the toast of Europe, because America was still not believing that it could really happen. But finally, they became very successful in America, of course, and obviously became very wealthy individuals as the inventors of the airplane. They could see it. They could see it. They could understand it. They could grasp what it would look like. And they never, ever stopped working on it. It's an amazing story of vision. Let's go to Genesis chapter 12. Probably the greatest example, or at least one of the greatest examples in the Bible of someone who had this kind of vision, and I say this kind of vision, that was of a physical object. We're talking about in a spiritual sense, but yet there is still a physical component to it. We're all human beings as well, would be the example of Abraham. Genesis 12, verse 1. Genesis 12, verse 1. Now the Lord had said to Abram, Abram is 75 years old at this time. He is a settled individual. Historians or secular history establishes him as being a very wealthy person. Of course, the Bible does as well. He had everything going for him, had his family and everything located in this one particular area. And God says to him, get out of your country, from your family and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. And bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Verse 4, so Abraham departed as the Lord had spoken to him. Now, maybe there was some discourse, but according to what we read in Scripture, he simply went, picked up and went. Why? Because he could see what God told him. Back to Hebrews 11, you'll see the reference there in verse 13. Hebrews 11, verse 13. Why did Abraham do what he did at age 75? Why was he willing to leave everything behind at age 75 and go and start all over again? Hebrews 11, verse 13. For these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. Abraham picks up and leaves. He saw what God told him. He had never been there, as far as we know. He had never seen that part of the world. And yet God said, this is where you're to go. And he gets up and he goes there. You know, when you think about ourselves and you think about faith, what do we see? What do we see in the future for all of us? You know, every year at the Feast of Tabernacles, I know we go through the 7 days of the feast, the last great day, as the ministry, you know, we feel obligated. It is our responsibility as much as we can to paint a picture of this future. What will it be like? What will it be like? There are many topics, of course, we can speak on in that reference when it comes to the Feast of Tabernacles. But primarily, we want you and me and all of us to see the future. We want you to be able to see what the millennium will really be like. We want you to see what the future holds for all of us. Now, it's only a glimpse, and it's only for, you know, a short period of time when you think about the 8 days. But how do you see that? You know, and of course, we could say this, and I say this myself, we could all do a better job of looking forward and, of course, living as though we are in that period of time. By that, I mean the way we treat one another, the way we live our lives every single day of the feast. You know, it used to be a whole different world, and we don't have that world today where we all camped, you know, just a few miles from here. And you could have been the wealthiest person in the church, or you could have been the poorest person in the church, and you had tents next to each other. You had a tent. And you were there because this was the future. This was the millennium. Now, I have to tell you, as a child, I thought if this is what the millennium is like, living in a tent, I'm not real sure I'm all for it. You know, it was that was a lot of fun as a kid in many ways. But, you know, I every year at the feast, we always had a cold spell that came through, and you always got everything wet in your tent at least once during the feast, and you had to wear your wet clothes, and I remember all that. But it was fun as a child, but it was still not like this hotel we stayed in last year at the feast, or the year before at the feast, or the resort we stayed at, or this place, or that place. But there was something special about it. And maybe we did. I don't know. Maybe we did a better job of talking about the future, talking about the millennium, talking about what the Feast of Tabernacles really pictures, and leaving the members every year with a picture in their mind, believing, understanding, and seeing the future, as we read in the case of Abraham. Vision is essential to faith. In fact, if you don't have vision, then do you really have faith? If you can't really see that, and again, I mean in your mind's eye, obviously it's not here. And you've still got to get up every morning. You've still got to go to work. You've still got to do things around your home. You've got to do all of those things. But what's in the back of your mind? What is it that you see every day? What happens when you get on your knees to pray every morning? Can you envision what God is really doing in your life and where that's taking you? See, that's faith. That's what God wants us to have. Abraham had that. That's why, of course, he's called the father of the faithful. But then look down to verse 24, Hebrews 11, verse 24. The second element of faith that's identified here in chapter 11. Second element of faith is verse 24. This is a story of Moses. Moses, of course, is a prominent figure in the Old Testament and a prominent figure here in chapter 11 as well. It says, by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child and they were not afraid of the king's command. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. Now, could Moses have lived as the son of Pharaoh's daughter and enjoyed things without having to fall into sin? I mean, isn't that possible to have beautiful things and wonderful things and not actually be sinning? Well, I'm sure it's possible. But the society of the Egyptians was so corrupt and so contrary to God, with multiple gods everywhere, that there really was not a lot of choice for Moses, if he saw that and understood it, that he could not do that without compromising the values that he knew the Hebrews, at that time as slaves, stood for, at least to some degree. You know, a lot of that had been lost by then among the Israelites, but there was still something there. And look at 1 Peter chapter 3. I want you to think about this. It's easy to sort of get along in the world, and by that compromise your value. Sometimes, you know, you can kind of make it work okay in the world, but is it really okay? Is it really okay? Shouldn't a Christian be someone different and unique? I don't mean odd in the sense of, you know, the way you act and conduct yourself, but standing out by the way you live your life in a world that's very, very corrupt and getting more so. Peter warned the church toward the end of the first century, he wasn't writing at the end of the first century, John did. John says even more about it, but Peter says about it as well. He says, okay, you're going to suffer persecution. You will. But he says, make sure it isn't for evil, but it's because you were doing good. Notice 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 17. He says, for it is better if it is the will of God to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. Now, why would Peter even have to say that? Isn't that clear to all of us that you shouldn't, you know, if you're being punished, you're being arrested because you stole something, you can't say I'm being persecuted as a Christian. You can't claim that. Or if you're doing something that's evil and you are caught and you're reprimanded for it, you can't claim that you are being persecuted because you're a Christian. But there are things you will be persecuted for. And those things are good. Good in the sense that you, as a Christian, stand out. You're different. You're a different person than the world. Look at chapter 4, verse 14. It says, if you are reproached for the name of Christ, blessed are you, for the spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. On their part, he is blasphemed, but on your part, he is glorified. If you're being persecuted or punished because you are obeying God, that's a good thing. Now, you may not think of it as a good thing. When you lose your job because you won't work on the Sabbath, or you lose, even your family sometimes because you're standing on God's word and God's way of life. But God says that's a good thing. Now, how can you see that? Well, it requires faith, doesn't it? Faith is seeing that, well, I'm doing what's right. As far as I know, I can't find anything. Now, we always have to examine ourselves. But I can't see that I'm doing anything wrong, and yet look at how I'm being persecuted. Look at how things just aren't going all that well as I try to do my job in this world. Well, he says, you know, faith tells you that that's what's going to happen. And you, with confidence, can go to the next day. And you can get up the next morning. And you go back to work the next day. Because you know you're doing what's right. And you know you're standing up for what is right. How do you know all of that? Well, of course, it's what you're standing on. It's the faith that's underneath you. He goes on to say in verse 15, but let none of you suffer as a murderer, a thief, an evildoer, or as a busybody in other people's matters. I've always thought it pretty curious that Peter compares, or in the same sentence, puts murder and a busybody. We would probably not do that. We say, oh, well, you know, that's okay. People can say whatever they want. We have the greatest ability today in the history of the world to spread false things over what is called the internet about anybody and anything you want. You can see why, I think we should be able to see why Peter puts being a busybody or obviously spreading things about people that are, in many cases, simply not true, as being maybe in the same category as killing someone or stealing from someone. Because you do severe damage to people when you do that. So Peter said, don't get caught doing those things. But if you are persecuted for doing good things and right things, that's a blessing. as a human being, it's hard to see a blessing when someone is hurting you. But Scripture refers to it as a blessing. Compromise is the way of life. It really is. And there's a lot of pressure from everyone, whatever business you're in, or whatever line of work or life you live, to compromise values in order to get along. It's everywhere you turn. Even in the world's Christianity, you can see that as well. Studies show that 75% of youth leave the faith, whatever their faith may be, by the age of 20. They abandon it by the age of 20, 75%. Someone sent me an article recently by a writer named Matt Walsh. I've seen some of his things before. He writes on the web, writes, I believe, for Blaze. I'm not sure if that's the correct place or not. I've seen his material before. But he was describing the problem in churches today. And you'd be surprised at what he says. If you ever find the article, I still have the link, I think, somewhere. But he writes this about it. He described a church, going to a church service. He said, I decided to go and find a church that would be really laid back, really, you know, sort of a nice, comfortable place to go. And he describes going to a church. So he said, I found one. He says, I went to the church service, and he says, people there were really laid back and casual. Choir members had shorts and flip-flops. The message was weak and inoffensive. The service had plenty of music and entertainment, but it wasn't working. Yet many of our, and this is a quote from his article, says, yet many of our fearless leaders, pastors, and pundits think this is, rather than the disease, it's the remedy. It's the same remedy they've been trying for half a century. As the problem gets worse, they don't change the medication. They just keep upping the dosage. They tell us that in order to bring the sheep into the fold, especially, and I'm quoting from his article, especially the millennial sheep, Christianity must be as unchristian as possible. It must be stripped of its truth, of its sacredness, of its sacrifice, of its morality, of its tradition, of its history, of its hardships, of its joy, and whatever is left will be enough to, if not engage and excite people, at least not scare them away. Christianity is failing because more and more of our leaders want to steal people from the true faith and deliver them to this convenient version. Now, again, we don't have to agree with everything this writer says, but he's writing about the churches in the world. And if you travel very much around, you'll see a lot of empty churches or churches on Sundays that have very few cars out front. As America becomes more and more a-religious, you know, where religion is not something that's very important to us as a nation, then you begin to see the church is failing. Statistically, every single year, 4,000 churches close their doors in America. 4,000 churches simply close their door. 80% of all churches in America are neither growing, oh, I'm sorry, they're either static or they are declining in attendance. 80% of churches in America. That's a pretty powerful statement about what's going on in the Christian world out there. And I'm not talking about the true Christian world, but as it's referred to in our society today. It's something is going on. And even the standards that we would associate with religion are becoming less and less noticeable as being really any standard. I read one author not long ago that said that it's almost impossible to identify a person who is a Christian, goes to church, and someone who does not. That their morality is, there's no difference. There's no difference in their lifestyle. There's no difference in how they go about their work. It's all the same. And I think I would agree with that from what I see. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't sincere people, aren't people that are really still trying. But to compromise values, to compromise who you are, is a lack of faith. It's an absence of faith. It's not the faith that we see described in Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11. Faith is not one of compromise. Faith is not one of compromise. Now, number three, the third lesson or principle of faith found in Hebrews 11. Notice verse 32. I find this one really interesting. When you think about this one, I hope you can see the value of this. Hebrews 11, verse 32. And again, we're talking about a whole group of individuals, and what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, and here it is, and out of weakness were made strong. Out of weakness were made strong. What does that mean? You know, words have meaning. What does it mean, out of weakness were made strong? It identifies every person in this list who was a man or woman of faith, recognized that they of and by themselves were weak. You know, there's something that we've tried to instill in our young people, in fact, in everyone, that you cannot overstate the importance of humility when it comes to any responsible position. Humility is very important. We used this phrase a couple of years ago to the young adults. Service before leadership, humility before position. Service before leadership, humility before position. The importance of that simple concept should not be lost on us. Every example here in this list, you're going to find individuals who came at some point in their lives to recognize how weak they really were. Whether it was a Daniel who occupied a very important position, or an Ezekiel who was a prophet, at some point they came to recognize how weak they were. And there's something significant about that. You can, and all, probably many of you here, if not all of you, have, you know, read Herbert Armstrong's autobiography. You read about sort of a conversion process that at some point has to include the idea that of and by myself, I am not very good. I'm really quite weak. I'm really quite weak. You know, one of the best examples in the Bible is found, let's go back to the book of Numbers. And although Moses isn't listed specifically in this list or in this section of the list, I think you understand that Moses had something unique. And it was so recognized. Numbers chapter 12. You know the story where Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses, verse 1, because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married, for he had married an Ethiopian woman. No dispute what he had done. Miriam and Aaron spoke out against him, and they said, "Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses?" Now, you're going to see two opposite attitudes here. There's no statement about what Moses, you know, Moses was human, Moses made mistakes, Moses did all sorts of things we can read about. But in this particular example, notice the two different attitudes. You have this sort of an arrogant attitude of Miriam and Aaron. We're as good as he is. We are as good as Moses is. Why can't God just work through us? Or why isn't God working through us? Verse 3, "Now the man Moses was very humble, more than all men who were on the face of the earth." That's quite a statement. Moses was more humble than any man on the face of the earth. Now, again, that's saying a lot. Moses was a very humble person, but he didn't start out that way. Go back to Exodus chapter 2, verse 11. It's an interesting story about the life of Moses. You can really divide Moses' life into three 40-year periods, essentially. You know, the first 40 years in Egypt, and the next 40 years in Midian, and then the next 40 years, of course, with bringing the children of Israel out of Egypt. But notice how it all began. At some point in Moses' life, he became aware that he was special and that he was going to be able to help the Israelites, and they were his people. And Moses, in his arrogance, believes he can do it. So look what happens. It came to pass, verse 11, Exodus 2, "In those days when Moses was grown, that he went out to his brethren and looked at their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. And he looked this way and that way, and when he saw no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand." And then he comes out the next day, and two Hebrew men were fighting. And they basically said, "Well, are you going to do to us what you did to the Egyptian?" Made Moses realize he had been seen and that he had done something that could cost him his life now. But Moses, and you, there's more in Josephus writes about Moses, that Moses really was a powerful person and a very arrogant person who thought, well, he could do this. He could go out. He's powerful enough. He killed this Egyptian. Didn't seem to have a big problem with him. We don't know anything about him, but he was able to take him down pretty quickly. At least it appears. So he's a strong man. He's an arrogant man. He was maybe a general in the Egyptian army. He could do it. He could do it. And then suddenly he realized maybe he couldn't. And he fled for his life. And for 40 years, you might say God worked on Moses for 40 years. And then finally, look at Exodus 4, verse 10. Compare the Moses in Exodus 2 who kills the Egyptian to the Moses in Exodus 4, 40 years later. Exodus 4, verse 10. God has just told Moses that I'm going to use you to bring the children of Israel out of Egypt. Rather than saying, oh boy, I know exactly how to do that. I was a general. I got all my plans laid out. I can go pull them out, blow the dust off, and we'll go and we'll take them by storm. We'll kill all the Egyptians and we'll bring them out. We can do it. Notice what he said. He said to the Lord, oh my Lord, I am not eloquent, neither before nor since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. Don't let me do it. I can't do it. Out of weakness, became strong. And Moses did some powerful things under the direction of God. Out of weakness, became strong. Until you recognize that you of and by yourself have no strength, then there is no room for faith. There is no room to build upon that foundation. There is no room to add to what God has given you. It's a very, very important concept. If we think we are all of that, if we think we have it all together, if we are so self-contained and able to consist by ourselves, then faith simply fades away because you don't need help. It's only when you recognize that you are really weak that God can use you and that foundation gets added to. Hebrews 11 is one of the more powerful chapters in the entirety of the Bible. It's a story about faith. It begins with faith is and concludes by describing in action how faith is built, how faith occurs. Now, there are many other scriptures. You know, faith comes by hearing is a verse that comes to mind. All of those are factors. I'm not trying to minimize any of that. Faith is one of the fruits of the Spirit. I'm not minimizing any of that. I'm simply saying, I'm focusing on Hebrews 11 and the story of faith that's listed there. Vision is required for faith. Suffering is required for faith. Human weakness or recognizing human weakness is required for faith. These are all lessons that are found in Hebrews 11. It isn't enough to know who you are. You also must know where you are going. You must believe it so strongly that you can actually see it. This is the essence of faith. This is the substance. The substance. Faith is the substance. It's the foundation. It's what you build upon. It's where you have to start. It's not where you necessarily end. By that, I don't mean that you don't increase in faith. But it's where you begin. It's the foundation upon which you must build. You must believe it so strongly that you can actually see it. This is real faith. It is faith that will take you into the kingdom of God. It is by faith that you see the end product. It is by faith that you see your future. It is by faith that you see the life you need to live. It is by faith that you will be saved. And therefore, to ask the question, is faith important? I doubt if there's anything more important than faith. Grasp it, treasure it, feed it, and grow it. Live by faith, walk by faith. Let's go to one more scripture before we conclude. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. I think 2 Corinthians chapter 4 describes the life that we all live and how we approach it with faith. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse, let's begin in verse 8. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 8. An interesting experience here about a month ago. We had a member died in Houston that I'd known for a long, long time. And I wasn't sure I could get down for the funeral. There were all kinds of things going on, and we were very, very busy. I decided on a Friday that I would fly down on Sunday, go to the funeral, and come back. And I mentioned to a couple of people I would be there. So I showed up for the funeral, walked in, and somebody handed me a program. And I opened it up, and it said I was doing the funeral. And that was the first I heard about it. So they came up, and they were just so apologetic. Said, oh, we're so sorry. Said, we heard you were coming. We just assumed you were going to do the funeral. And we put it in the print. I said, well, you know, what am I supposed to do now? So Mr. Servideo was there. He said, oh, no, don't worry. I knew that. And I told him that, you know, that was not right. And I'll be doing the funeral. I said, okay, fine. He said, but, you know, you should probably come up and say something. Your name is in there. And so I said, okay, fine. I can do that. And I'd been studying this subject of faith, of course, in preparation at that time for the weekend. And this series of verses came to mind, and I really felt comfortable repeating these verses there at the funeral because it described life. It really told us the journey of life and what it's really all about. Notice what Paul writes here. Verse 8, we are hard-pressed on every side. Life is hard. You just get beaten up in life, yet not crushed. We are perplexed but not in despair. Persecuted but not forsaken, struck down but not destroyed, always carrying about in the body the dying of the Lord Jesus, that the life of Jesus also may be manifested in our body. What Paul writes here is that life is going to deal you some very difficult blows. There are days when you're going to feel hard-pressed, you know, or as some would say, hard-put upon, but you can't let it crush you. You're going to be perplexed. There are things that you just can't figure out. You know, over the many years in the ministry, I've seen in people's lives and in my own life some things that I just can't figure it out. You know, I used to say, you know, growing up in the church and everything was great. I went to college. Everything was wonderful. Everything was fine. That, you know, there is no problem that I can't figure out. I can figure out anything. There's a solution to everything. Well, it wasn't long that I realized that wasn't true. I was perplexed a few times and have been over the years, perplexed, but not in despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Why? Always carrying about in the body the dying of the Lord Jesus, that the life of Jesus also may be manifested in our body. We observe Passover once a year. But hopefully it isn't once a year only that we think about what Christ went through and what that means for us. And we transform ourselves into living like He did every day. You know, every morning when you get up and you get on your knees to pray, you should pray to God that you are a better person today than you were yesterday. You can't change yesterday, but you can do better today. And I can do better today. But only if we're able to see what Christ wants us to be like and strive for that. Verse 11, for we who live are always delivered to death for Jesus' sake, that the life of Jesus also may be manifested on our mortal flesh. So then death is working in us, but life in you. And since we have the same spirit of faith, according to what is written, very, very interesting verse that he quotes from the book of Psalms. I believe, and therefore I spoke. We also believe, and therefore speak. I believe, and therefore I speak. No matter what's happening in your life, that faith has to be there, and you are speaking and acting because it's what you believe. You are a genuine person. You are a Christian who knows where he's going. And you speak because you believe it. You know, what's hard to find in this world today is someone who is sincere. It's really hard to find. If you've been watching, of course, the elections that are going on, it is so difficult to find anyone who is sincere. We must be sincere. We must believe, and therefore we must speak. knowing, verse 14, that he who raised up the Lord Jesus will also raise us up with Jesus and will present us with you. The faith, the confidence to know what the future holds. Psalm 116, and let's just turn there. That's what Paul is quoting. And if you haven't read this psalm, surely you've read it before, but if you haven't read it in a while, I think it speaks profoundly to this entire subject, and I think that's why Paul quoted it. Life can be very difficult. Sickness can strike at any time. Accidents can occur. Things can happen that you never dreamed would happen to you or your family. How do you handle those? How do you handle them? Verse 10. Well, actually, let's go back to verse 8. Psalm 116, verse 8. For you have delivered my soul from death, my eyes from tears, and my feet from falling. I will walk before the Lord in the land of the living. I'm not running away. I'm not going to go and hide. I'm going to walk in the land of the living. I believed, therefore I spoke. This is what I believe, and this is what I'm going to do. I am alive. I'm going to stand up. I'm going to do what God told me to do. The faith that holds me up. So very, very important. God wants us to come to this point in our lives where we have total faith in Him to take care of us no matter what. We walk in the land of the living, but we walk before the Lord. This is Christianity in its purest form. Hebrews 11 describes 16 people who I am declaring for you today are in the hall of faith. Not because they're the only ones that are there or the only ones that will be there. You and I have a wonderful opportunity to do just that. The examples of faith in Hebrews 11 are for us to follow and for us to watch, for us to learn and for us to grow, so that one day we can also enter the hall of faith and become the children of God in His kingdom. We know where we're going and we know how to get there. We walk in the land of the living. We walk by faith and not by sight.